I will go, Lord,
if you lead me.
Oh, we don't do ripping in our church, okay?
Oh, we don't either.
No.
We don't either. This is me just feeling it. The Spirit is moving through me.
Your people in my heart.
Hold on to your church hat, folks. We're about to begin. Please turn to number 273 in your worship hymnal.
Buckle your seatbelts. Keep your hands, arms, and legs inside the pew. Here we go.
Please stand.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Poor Unfortunate Podcast. I'm Caroline Ametti.
And I'm Connor Perkins. Welcome to all of our listeners who are returning. It's great to have you with us again. And for those of you who are new, welcome. We love having you here. Please remember to hit follow or subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast. That way, all of our episodes download right to your device without you even having to think about it. And then, if you like the episode, please remember to leave a rating and a review. It takes like 30 seconds, if that, at the end of the episode. And it just helps everyone else find the podcast even better. And for those of you who are returning, if you haven't done that either, let's make that happen. I forgot. I have to ask the question.
Thank you, Caroline.
What's new?
So the first thing that popped into my mind is a bit of casting news that came out yesterday, and that is the Evil Queen in the live-action Snow White that will be coming, that's starring Rachel Zegler as Snow White. The Evil Queen will be played by Gal Gadot.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I'm here for that.
Yeah, and then we also found out that the Tower of Terror live-action movie is going to be directed by Taika Waititi.
Taika Waititi. Oh, it's going to be so good.
Pretty
and
damn
ScarJo
cool.
is and supposed ScarJo, to be attached
right.
to it.
Right. Yeah. Is she cool with Disney now?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like you'd have to be.
Yeah. Interesting.
I think it's going to be good. Taika Waititi, like, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
It's going to be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Holiday decor is up in the parks. That happened the day after Halloween, as usual. So the parks are decorated for Christmas and the holidays now.
The Encanto premiere happened.
Yes.
So that's coming out Thanksgiving time.
Woo.
Tonight is the first look preview of Eternals, mm-hmm. which that's coming out. And that looks pretty great, too.
That does.
Tonight's actually like a really big night. We're recording this on Thursday, the 4th of November.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also opening night for the Winnie the Pooh show in New York City. So there's lots of Disney openings that are happening right
mm-hmm.
now.
Ah, yes. We love to see things opening. Ah, that makes me feel good. Speaking of the Winnie the Pooh show opening tonight in New York City, Connor and I were lucky enough to get to see the show last weekend.
Oh, it was magical.
It was magical.
Oh, I cried. Oh, that there is some Disney magic happening with that show. The puppetry, the music, the set, the effects, the lighting. It's just everything is working with this show. It was, oh, God.
We were captivated, and I looked around, and all of the kids in the audience were captivated as well. Like, it hits the perfect balance between good for kids, but it doesn't talk down to anybody.
Yeah.
It's magical. And we have some more things to say about it, but you will just have to stay tuned, and we will talk a bit more about the Winnie the Pooh show. But, oh, we really encourage you, if you're going to be in the New York area, whether you have kids or not, we highly, highly recommend giving the show
go
a visit.
Go see it. If you're an adult, sit towards the back, and then you can just sort of cry alone in your corner.
Because
you will cry.
Yep.
You will cry.
Yep.
These actors are absolutely
phenomenal. Oh, my gosh.
The McDonald's toys are over.
Oh, they're
I did not hit.
They're beyond over, okay? Because we started, the last couple of Happy Meals that we ordered, they had the gall to give us Happy Meal toys from last year when we were trying to collect all the parks ones from last year. That's what I got. And I was like, are you kidding me?
Awful.
Now I get Mickey. Awful. Now.
I know.
The nerve.
But needless to say, I did not hit 50. We gave it a run for our money. I think we had like 8 more left to go. Mm-hmm. But I do just want to take a moment real quick and say a special thank you and shout out to Melinda, who heard that I was really looking for a Gus Gus. She had an extra one and she mailed me this Gus Gus. And he's my little pride and joy. Melinda, God, you're the best. Thank you so much.
You don't have no idea, like seeing that pop up in our inbox. It just like we really, y'all out there listening are really, really the best of the best. And we just really, really appreciate you. Just as we're getting towards the holiday season, just know that we really love and appreciate you. And little gestures like that that show us that you're listening mean so much to us.
I know. It feels like we're sometimes just speaking into the void here. Yeah. What a lovely void you all are.
Well, that's the perfect segue into today's episode because it is completely inspired by another one of our amazing listeners, Kiana Clare, who is also Miss Teen Canada 2020, people.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, girl, so, get it.
Yes, get it. Kiana reached out and told us that she had a feeling that we might enjoy the Twisted Tales book series. And we're going to give you a whole background and more information on what that is. But long story short, we were like, yeah, we will totally give that a shot. And boy,
and she was 100%
was she right.
So 100%
this one is for you, girl. Thank you so much for such a fantastic suggestion. So this episode is our showdown episode. And our showdown is going to include a book from the Twisted Tales series. And this one is called Part of Your World. So you might know which characters it is centered upon. Little Mermaid. And therefore, we decided to look at this next to The Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea, because they are both stories of what happens after the events that occur in the original Little Mermaid film, but in very, very different ways.
Yeah, we're going to harken back to the very first showdown that we ever did, which was between the live action Beauty and the Beast and live action Cinderella, where instead of waiting until the end of the episode to make a decision as to which one is the winner, we're going to make a case right out of the gate as to which of these two sequels to The Little Mermaid is better than the other. Spoiler alert. Kiana was completely right.
Yes.
And Part of Your World, A Twisted Tale, is clearly the superior choice when you're looking at these two. And so this episode, we're going to tell you why.
Yes, this book is the Little Mermaid sequel that we all deserve. And really, we cannot encourage you enough to get this book, to read this book. It'll be a little bit difficult, I would say, to talk about some of the parts of it that are amazing without some spoilers. So we'll try to go light on them so that you can enjoy the book in your own time. But just there may be a few.
Yeah. But also, if you want to take that time right now to read the book or even like skim a plot synopsis and then rewatch Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea, we'll give you that time to do that right now. And welcome back. So, no pun intended, let's dive into some background information on Part of Your World, A Twisted Tale, and Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to start with the book so that I can give you a little bit more information about what this book actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So it was released on September 4th, 2018. The publisher is Disney Hyperion, and it was written by Liz Broswell. Other books that she's done, Snow and RX, they're under the name Tracy Lynn. She's also done the Nine Lives of Chloe King series under her name.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of the Twisted Tales series from the Disney publishing company, Disney Hyperion. And the Twisted Tales series is a collection of books by a few different female-identifying authors. So Liz Broswell, Jen Kalanita, Elizabeth Lim, and Farah Rashan. And they take a beloved Disney movie and, kind of like the Marvel Comics and Disney Plus series, What If?, ask the question, what if something else happened? So essentially, it's Disney-published fan fiction that allows you to create some alternative stories to the films that you know and love. So some of the other books in the series, there are currently 12 books, with a 13th and 14th coming in 2022 and a 15th coming in 2023.
Oh, are you kidding me? And they include
books... Oh, no, I'm not kidding you.
Oh.
And they include books such as A Whole New World, Once Upon a Dream, As Old as Time, Reflection, Mirror, Mirror, What Once Was Mine, Go the Distance, On Birthday, and more. I will tell you some of the new ones that are coming out. One is Princess and the Frog themed.
Yes.
Where Tiana remains human through the entire book. So... That's going to be one
chills.
To... Yeah. There's no official announcement on what the actual twist is, but...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, for Part of Your World, it's a 480-page book, though I will tell you it's a speed read because the target audience, it's a young adult novel. Age range is usually around 12 to 17 for this novel.
Okay, because I was going to say, the vocabulary, the structure was pretty sophisticated. I did not feel like I was reading a young adult book, and I enjoy them, but it felt very sophisticated to me. I was impressed.
It's 12 to 17, but very short chapters. It's the third person, but shifts perspectives of the different characters from chapter to chapter. So it's a really, you know, quick-paced book.
Yeah.
You'll move through it pretty quickly, so don't let 480 pages stop you here. 3.79 out of 5 stars on Goodreads, 4.7 out of 5 stars on Audible. I guess that these are comparable to Rotten Tomatoes and things like that. Yeah. I don't know. So now the part that I know you're all asking yourself, what is the premise of this book? So the what if question for Part of Your World is, what if Ariel had never defeated Ursula? And this is the plot synopsis that comes from the back of the book. So it's been 5 years since the infamous sea witch defeated the Little Mermaid and took King Triton's life in the process. Ariel is now the voiceless queen of Atlantica, while Ursula runs Prince Eric's kingdom on land. But when Ariel discovers that her father might still be alive, she finds herself returning to a world and a prince she never imagined she would see again. So that's in essence what this book is about. And I'll just leave it there. So now we can do some background information about Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea.
All right, Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea. So this film was released direct to video on September 19th, 2000. It's directed by Jim Cameron, who was an animator on The Swan Princess, which we love. And
there were serious Swan Princess vibes I was getting with this movie.
Oh, interesting. I kind of understand why. Yes, I understand why. Swan Princess is just so good, though. But here's the interesting thing. He had creative roles, whether writing, directing, animating, on Pocahontas 2, 101 Dalmatians 2, Tarzan 2, Fox and the Hound 2. And I'm like, all right, he's made the career.
He's the sequel dude.
Yes. As well as Brian Smith. He's the
direct-to-video sequel.
Yes, yes. And Brian Smith directed as well. It's written by Elizabeth Anderson, Temple Matthews, Elise Dehane, and Eddie Guzelian. The music is by Danny Troob. I mean, where do we even begin on all the things Danny Troob has done? Who has orchestrated, like, additional orchestrations for Tangled, orchestrated Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella on Broadway, was an arranger and additional composer for Brandy Cinderella, was an arranger orchestrator for Hercules, an additional orchestrator for Hunchback, and so much more. He is incredible. Oh, my gosh. And so on that note, this film includes 4 original songs: Down to the Sea, Tip and Dash, For a Moment, and Here on the Land and Sea. There was also a cut song called Gonna Get My Wish. This movie includes voice talent from the original film, which I think is quite a feat, including Jodie Benson as Ariel, Samuel E. Wright as Sebastian, Pat Carroll now as Morgana, who is Ursula's sister. We'll get there.
I'll have more
Kenneth
to say
Mars
about
as King Triton. Oh, me too. Oh, honey. And Buddy Hackett as Scuttle.
The fact that they got Buddy Hackett to come back for like a throwaway part in this movie, like Scuttle is.
It goes to show you how much the original film and characters mean. Ugh, yes.
Yeah.
And then we have some new cast members, including Tara Strong as Melody, Rob Paulsen as Eric, so replacing the original actor, Max Casella as Tip, Stephen First as Dash, and Clancy Brown as Undertow. This film has a 5.6 on IMDb and a 17% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Ooh.
It made 100. I'm like, is this number correct? It made $121 million in retail revenue, the 10th most successful video of 2000. Interesting. I remember going out and buying the VHS from the Disney store at the mall like the day it came out. So
yeah, I'm sure
a lot of other
kids
did too. Yeah.
This one was a big one. There was a lot of excitement around this just because, one, The Little Mermaid was so well loved, and two, there had never been an official like sequel to it.
Yeah. So my plot synopsis, I'm sorry for the sass in advance. So in what ends up being a total rehash of the plot of The Little Mermaid, we pick up about 2 years after Ariel marries Prince Eric. They have a new baby girl, Melody, who they bring out to sea to meet her mer family and celebrate her being a child of two worlds. But the happy event is interrupted by Ursula's sister, Morgana. Like, y'all, she's a thinner version of Ursula, voiced by the same actor, with the same but less interesting personality and wants. But I digress. So Morgana attempts to kidnap Melody in order to blackmail King Triton. But after chasing her off, Ariel decides that Melody must be kept away from the sea while Morgana still lives. She returns a locket that Triton had made for Melody, bids her sea family farewell, and walls off the palace, never telling Melody who she truly is. But by age 12, Melody cannot resist sneaking to the sea that feels like home. And when she finds a mysterious locket with her name on it, she strikes up a deal with a sea witch who wants Triton's power, changes her form, and then she tries to set things right with the help of her aquatic friends. Sound familiar? Because it is.
So because we are us, we are going to be looking at this book and this movie through a very specific lens that we like to call deepening. So we're going to be looking at how both of these sequels deepen the story of The Little Mermaid through two different ways. One, the world building. So, you know, really things that are more plot centric. And then the other is characters, both how we're expanding on the old ones and introducing some new ones who do some fun things. So let's take a look at the world building that's happening in both of these sequels. Let's see what's going well and what's not going well and why the book does a much better job. Mm-hmm. So if we're starting with Part of Your World, A Twisted Tale, some of the things that I just wanted to point out right away as to what we're getting with this book. First off, on a very basic level, we finally get the name of Prince Eric's kingdom. It's called Terulia.
Yeah.
Which I just, it's a little thing.
I forgot. Yeah, we did not know
it. But I loved that we had that because it just, I don't know. It's in the same way that like, you know, Corona. We know that Corona is the kingdom for Tangled. And it puts something more concrete in place so that then your fantasy can sort of go a bit more specific with the world that you're working with.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
One of the reader complaints that I saw a lot was the fact that the chapters would shift the third person perspective to different character points of view. But for me, however, I think that this is actually a really useful tool in building a larger scope for a story altogether. It makes it feel much more epic, much more cinematic. We get to have private moments with all the characters and hold more information as the reader than any single character would in the way that, you know, movies and the way that, you know, TV also work. Game of Thrones is actually written in this same way.
Yeah,
so if we want to talk about world building and something that's epic, this is taking a way of writing that's in one of the most epic stories that's been told. I'll say there are times that I don't think the perspective actually needed to shift, or the style of the writing could have adapted a bit more with each of the characters a little bit more specifically, but I didn't mind it at all. I do want to say our friends at Book of the Mouse Club, they did an episode on this book and they had mentioned how great it would be for this to be turned into like a Disney Plus series. And before I had fully listened to their episode about that, I had the exact same idea with this. This would work perfect as like a Disney Plus limited series or like an anthology series with the way that these stories are being told.
Oh, but I need like Mandalorian level budget, though. I will accept nothing less. Oh, 100%. Oh, my gosh. Yes.
100%. But really, this whole story just feels much more sophisticated than I was originally expecting. Mm. We're really taking some time with the story, especially in the exposition, to understand where these characters have been and what they've been feeling over the 5 years since the wedding incident. So this book picks up 5 years after the incident on the ship where Ariel and Vanessa slash Ursula are all, you know, there after Flounder is like a total boss and, you know, swims her out there on the barrels like a damn hero. So there is a reality to the story that I appreciate. Things are thought through a bit more, from the power of the Trident sinking up to the tide to using the seagulls as surveillance for a castle that has so many windows, to the ancient sign language of the Myrrh, because that's how Ariel has to communicate and what it feels like for Ariel to try and rule as a silent queen. There's so much specificity around the consequences of the original story that it did so well at grounding the book in this harsher reality that still feels of the same world. It's one that's just a little bit less polished. We're looking at the world of this story through the more wizened and jaded eyes of the characters who lost.
Oh my gosh, speaking of like, you know, the power of the Trident being tied to the tide, not only was the world of Terulia extremely vivid and Atlantica was even more expanded, but then the mythology in this, like, we did not have to go that hard and we did. Between the development of what the gods mean both to the Myrrh and human people, the different kinds of mermaid runes that exist, mermaid immortality versus human mortality. I also loved a hearkening back to the original Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale in which when mermaids die, they turn into foam. Ariel talks about that a bit in this, which I love. The rules of sea magic being on land and vice versa. I mean, I could go on and on. It honestly, it just added so much more depth that got me then in turn filling this mythology into the original film, and everything matched. And it was brilliant. And I think overall, that's what this does so well, is that this added so much mature depth to these characters and this world that we know, while still making everything gel with the original film. Nothing felt forced in, like, we're going to try to make this darker for, you know, teens and grownups. But then you're like, wait, but that doesn't match up with the person that I know from the film. Everything was extremely cohesive, and that is no easy feat, and I don't even know how that was done. And I also did not know, maybe this is just me, but I really didn't know what was going to be coming next in this story. Like 3/4 of the way through, I was very convinced that there was a certain character that was going to die. And I was just like, really, my heart was pounding at one point. I'm not even going to lie to you. I felt so invested the entire time. It felt very possible that things could either turn out happily or not. I could not get a gauge when I was reading this. I'm like, is it all going to turn out in the end? Or is this going to be one of those books about how it doesn't always turn out in the end? I had no idea. And it just made me overall examine the thought of, I think it's occurred to me before, was the original story truly a happy ending? Obviously, it's so much better than the reality that we're dealing with in this story in which Ursula wins. But I remember always thinking when I would watch the finale of the movie, I'm like, like Ariel is giving up literally every single thing she knows and everybody she loves to then adjust to Eric's world. And it always felt a little bit off to me considering that Ariel is very much like her own person.
Yeah.
And at the end of the book, again, trying to avoid spoilers, the way that it all closed up felt so satisfying, but also just right to me. And so then I'm like, oh my gosh, did this in its own way kind of improve the original story?
I put down. That's my favorite part of the entire book, is the way the ending happens, because it just feels a little bit more realistic because it's not tidy. It's not all tied up in a bow for you. God. You don't really know how it's going to end when all is said and done, because it's a wholly original story that really just uses The Little Mermaid as a jumping off point. It's also not trying to go back and explain away all the plot holes that might have existed in the original story so that it itself loses its own identity. It just sort of takes enough of what it needs to construct something completely its own. And that's what keeps the reader engaged. And that's what keeps you guessing what could happen. Because one, we've never seen Disney work in this way before, of like, we're blowing this wide open and anything could happen because the villain won. And, you know, we're not predicting what's happening next because we're not relying on the crutch of the previous story or even the sort of standard format for a Disney movie script. We have no, we don't have those foundations that we're relying on. For me, it read very similarly to like Peter and the Star Catchers, where they felt free to get messy with the original story, change some things, make some things make sense, but introduce some other things that, you know, may be hard for us to reconcile with the original story. And that makes it interesting to me. Like, and now we're able to bring some new things to all the characters, like, you know, bringing in issues of feminism, ableism, ocean conservation, imperialism.
Yes.
All of these things are now tied into this story. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, the way that it's described of Ariel when she is voiceless, ruling her kingdom through sign language. Like, there's a moment where she talks about how when her sisters turn their back on her and swim away.
Yes.
That is the end of the conversation. And normally, if you wanted to have the last word, you could call after them. And even if they aren't looking at you, you could have the last word. And no matter what she signs, if they aren't looking at her, she doesn't get the last word. And I was like, that was something that just, the specificity of that moment to me really hit home, the ableism that is sort of ingrained in cultures of governing and things like that, and how that's worked in. And it's just like, it's something that I would not expect to see in a Disney, a Disney story. And here it is, just like,
you're right,
put right out, like, there in the beginning.
Even the idea that she would have to work around the fact that rulers make proclamations to the entire kingdom, and she just has to have Sebastian and Flounder kind of place themselves in the crowd and help her out as she signs. It's just like things you wouldn't think of. And the whole idea of, okay, Ariel loses her voice in the original film for 3 days. That's tough. It's a challenge. But then you're like, oh, what if it was for 5 years? The idea of that is what, when we were considering which of the Twisted Tales we were going to read, that idea is what really grabbed me about the story of, like, what does she do when that becomes her reality for years and years? And yeah, it was very, very moving.
The only weakness that I have here compared to Little Mermaid 2 is the visualization that comes with it. Book of the Mouse Club, they mentioned this as well, and this is a very small thing, but I want a map. I'm a sucker for maps at the beginning of the book.
Oh, yeah.
And I would have loved to see the layout of the neighboring kingdoms, where Atlantica sits in the sea, etc. So
yeah,
that
we get a lot
as a
of
reader,
info
I can,
about those neighboring kingdoms.
Yeah, I want to more readily be able to take part in, you know, Ursula slash Vanessa conquering the realm, knowing where these distances are so that I can appreciate more of what is actually happening in terms of just travel and distance and things like that. It's not a deal breaker for me, but I think it would have been a really welcome addition to the book.
And I really only had one weakness for this book, and it's in the climax of the book. Again, I will not spoil anything. I will talk around it. In the climax of the book, things tied together a little bit neatly and without the explanation that was offered for so many things throughout a book that took a lot of twists and turns that felt very unpredictable to me. Even though the ultimate ending of the book I think is fantastic, the climax felt a little too neat for the kind of story we were being told up until this point. And the climax almost felt like a bit of like an animated movie climax rather than this much more textured, dark story that we were getting told up until this point.
I would agree with that. And I think it also, in the same way of feeling a little bit tidy, it at the same time was not very clear what exactly was happening.
Yes.
And it felt like it was sort of purposefully being unclear about what was happening in order to create suspense, where I would have rather had that suspense created by, you know, a really more interesting action sequence that was happening. I think there was just another way to do it that felt more in line with the rest of the book that we were reading.
Yes, yes, agreed.
But all in all, in terms of really deepening the world of this story by creating a plot that takes The Little Mermaid to another level, this book is light years ahead of what Little Mermaid 2 Return to the Sea is doing. Even though Little Mermaid 2 has the advantage of being something that's visual, where we can, you know, see and hear things.
Yeah.
I think they really use that not to their advantage here. I mean, what the fucking place is this that there are polar ice caps, but also warm beaches with crabs who have Jamaican accents? I have less of an idea where we are than I ever have before. This world makes no sense. The locations make no sense. It feels sloppy even for a direct-to-video movie. I mean, I felt more confident in where locations were by them just telling me in the book that the name of the kingdom was called Terulia than I did when all of a sudden Morgana's hideout is in a fucking iceberg.
Yeah.
What the hell? How does this make sense?
And it's hard because when we talked about doing these two things, once we both read the book and found out how fantastic it was, we were having a bit of a conversation of how do we compare these two things? And I think even within thinking of this film, it is a direct to, you know, DVD, VHS sequel. I think even judging it by those parameters, it doesn't offer as much up as other things of its kind have. And like, for me, more than a lot of other Disney classics, The Little Mermaid has a lot of questions hanging in the air, even with the happy ending.
Yeah.
Will Ariel, like, go back and forth between the land and the sea? How did she do adjusting to the human world forever? Like, there were so many things to explore. And instead, this film chose to just simply repeat the plot of the original film. Girl makes a deal with the sea witch to change her form and the world she feels out of place in. The witch tries to take Triton's power. The girl tries to make it right. And I understand pretty much the only strength I had of this was that the plot centering on Ariel's child is a good idea. I think it's a fun way to look at the characters that we love from the original film without trying too hard to think about how to make another story star Ariel again. Even though, like, I love her, I can never get enough of her. And even though I understand that this isn't about Ariel, she is our anchor, literally, no pun intended. I didn't even realize I just wrote that down. And I think that we needed more of her tied up in the plot, more of how she feels in her new life, or more of who she is now that she's a grown princess and a mother. Not even, we'll talk about character later, but just plot-wise, something about Ariel needed to anchor the plot. And I don't know. Again, this dips a little bit into character as well, but if we're going to center the plot on Ariel's child, which I think is a good idea, the idea of a child of two worlds is used in literature and film all of the time. I talk about Wicked every episode. It's just a thing now. Frozen 2. I mean, Harry Potter in its own way. Like, these characters are often super complex and come with interesting challenges. And I think, you know, the opening song literally says, there's never been, not ever before, a child born of sea and shore. And that could have been the jumping off point of the plot right there of what happens. What is that child like? And I think that would have just been so much more of an interesting thing to explore, because then that would deepen The Little Mermaid. It would say, okay, now in a way the two worlds have come together, but not fully until it's in this person, Melody, and what happens then.
In a way, they had an opportunity to go in the same way that Frozen does, where give her more of the experience of what it's like to live with the sea and the land, and then let the tragic thing happen where it has to be taken from her. Like, like that sort of thing. Like, when you think about how Elsa knows what she's done to her sister and has to live with that, and how Anna has those memories removed from her, like, that's really interesting, because it's a little bit more complicated. It's a little bit messier. And I don't think that they went as messy as they could have gone with this, because I just sort of felt like they were looking for the easiest and most direct path to get to an ending.
Are we asking for too much from a direct-to-video sequel? I don't know. I don't think so.
Because you know what? I just feel like you shouldn't handle a direct-to-video sequel any differently than you should a theatrically released sequel. I mean, I know budget-wise you have but in terms, one of the things that doesn't dictate, isn't dictated by the budget, is the quality of the story that you come up with and the ideas that you have.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that they were asking enough questions of themselves to figure out what is the more interesting story to be told about Melody, about her child. And I think they were getting there because it is dealing with some of the same themes as the book, which we like the book.
Yeah.
Of like bringing the worlds of the land and sea together. I mean, I think that being said, like that's a great theme, but it sort of plays second fiddle to what is the same focus as the Little Mermaid theme, which is giving something up in exchange for something that you actually, you know, needed and sort of wanted all along. Like it just... That's a less interesting plot to me than how do we bring these two worlds together? Because that's where we started. And then we just sort of let that one take the back seat. But I think the other sort of strength of this story is a sort of silver lining in flipping the script, is that it's an opportunity to revisit some of the relationships from the original film and see how the lessons learned in The Little Mermaid are applied in the same way that we experience in the book. So most notably, I sort of love that we get an opportunity to grow the relationship between Ariel and Triton.
They were the most interesting characters to me
in the whole movie.
He really figured some of his stuff out. Yeah, he was like, yeah, oh,
there's much more respect between the two of them.
He said he gives Melody the choice. He's like, you want to live in the sea? And he would never have done that before.
Exactly.
Claps for him.
Exactly. There's more respect. It's cool to see them now on the same team rather than against one another. And it feels like the logical next step for the relationship. So I feel like that was actually executed really well. And I almost sort of would have rather watched an entire movie about Ariel and her relationship with her father as she's trying to learn to raise a kid than I was invested in just Melody. Because, I mean, I love those moments that we get of Ariel where, you know, when she puts her feet in the water and she's just like breathing into the night air. That's the best part of the
whole movie.
And like, and the transformation moment when she decides that she needs to go after and look for Melody. I'm like, those are the moments that feel much deeper, much more grounded. And it's because they're based in Ariel's relationships with some of the people that that we already know. But yeah, it's in general, Little Mermaid 2 is a much more stripped down, bare bones version of the original story. We're really getting rid of the love interest part of it. And so now the only focus is that Melody just wants to be a mermaid because she likes the sea and it's been kept from her, which, that gets the job done. But is it the most compelling? No. And is it going to be compelling enough for us to, you know, get us on her side of the struggles that she's having in the way that we were on Ariel's side in the original story? Again, no, with Ariel, it's not just that she wants to explore the land. She also has fallen in love. So the stakes are a lot more higher for her. And because we're not adding any sort of additional element for Melody, the stakes don't feel very high for her in terms of actually staying in the sea. Like, there's no way when Triton makes the choice of, gives her the choice of, you can stay on land with your parents or you can live in the sea. There's no way I believe that that's an actual choice that she's going to make to live in the sea. Like, we needed to actually be like, oh my God, what is she going to choose? We know what she's going to choose because there's nothing, nothing for her in the sea other than I get to be a mermaid and it's been kept from me, which that's not compelling enough to get us to the climax of the film.
I wish there could have been a song. If she had a more of a conflict about that, a song about that, because also I didn't become tied to her journey and her wants and desires anymore through her song either. So it was kind of just like killing time for me.
Yeah.
Just like that song a little bit.
Yeah. Which I mean, I also feel like in the way of that song, just killing time, it's because I think they're more interested in that song doing direct callbacks to the original film than actual plot action.
Mm-hmm. There's a difference between an homage and just a frame-by-frame copy over and over and over again. Homages are super fun and, like, take you a minute to see. But this was just all reusing, like, even some of the expressions that Melody had. Like, I know she's Ariel's daughter, but I'm like, did you take the frame?
Yeah.
I get it. I mean, sometimes they literally do that to save money. But it just didn't, it wasn't in a fun way. Yeah, it wasn't fun.
And her character design even is like, and this is, again, getting sort of in the character realm, but her character design is... she is Ariel, but with black hair from her father.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I would have loved to see Melody actually be a little bit more of her own person.
Yeah.
Because I think that's more interesting for Ariel of, like, what happens when, in the same way that you were your own person for Triton and he was having a struggle with that, what is it like for you to now have a kid who is very much her own person?
And it's back to that original thing that they didn't mind enough, which is, okay, a human and a mermaid had a child. Is that child going to look kind of different? Yeah, probably, but she didn't look different at all. Ugh.
Okay, so I think that's as deep as we probably need to go in terms of the actual world building. It really is no comparison between these two. This book, Part of Your World, does such a good job of just, at the bare minimum, giving us a brand new story that we can enjoy with characters that we love who are facing real challenges as a result of the original story, where with Little Mermaid 2, we're just getting the same. We're just getting more of the same. And I don't think that's enough to constitute a sequel.
And I promise, if you were out there relying on Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea, just to get some more of that world, please read this book. If you were just like, who wasn't into the vibes of, like, Prince Eric's castle and the beach and the ocean and all of that? If you just wanted more of that, this book will give you everything that you ever asked for and more. I promise you. Please.
It really will.
Please.
So now that we've done world building and the plot, let's take a look at these characters, the new ones that have been added and some of the old ones that are returning and being built out a little bit more. Okay, so looking at some of these characters, I just sort of called out three characters in particular and how they were expanded upon in Part of Your World that I think are really done well. So the first is Ariel. I really like the Ariel that we get in this book. In many ways, I think a little bit more than the Ariel in the original story.
Yes.
She just, she feels exactly right for her age and for the target audience. But I love that we're just giving her a little bit more gravitas. The descriptions of her eyes in particular as being more wearied, wise, and older, it told me everything that I needed to know about her.
Yeah.
But Ariel, she still feels like the same sort of Ariel. She has her whiny moments. She has her spontaneous moments. Yeah. But all the rest, we get to see her learn some of the lessons from the events of The Little Mermaid and apply them here.
Yes.
It's described for us in the book, the moments where she wants to do something that she normally would have done. And she takes a second and thinks it through. And it makes it all the more interesting when she changes what she would have normally done and, like, holds back. I think of, like, what happens in the climax where normally she would be someone who's, like, running to fix the problem. And instead she's sort of, like, holding back until she absolutely has to intervene, which is something that Ariel would never do in the original story. But also in the moments where she's like, I really, really want to do this, but I know that I shouldn't. But I'm going to do it anyway. Those are so much more interesting. Like, I think about her with the Nautilus shell.
That's exactly what I thought about her. My love for her was so deepened by being able to see her look at her past choices with, like, a judgment that, like, she's kind of close to our age now that we all feel. I felt so much, like, closer to her as a character. But exactly like you said, she was still the Ariel from the film.
And also that judgment that we as audiences have put on Ariel in hindsight, where we're like, how could you have not seen that? How could you have not seen that?
Yeah.
And here in the book, she's like, how could I have not seen that? I'm like, yes, 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 yes.
Exactly, exactly. And then, you know, when she's trying to hold herself back from being that old impulsive Ariel, I love also too, she really is so self-aware all the time, which is just like I found so to be so clear and relatable. And she'll want to do certain things that she is like, oh, I'm the queen now. I can't do that. There's one thing that stood out to me. Like she's on the beach with Eric and like she's feeling afraid and the wind is blowing and she's like she's hugging herself. And she was like she would never let herself do that underwater where the people of Atlantica could see her do it because she has to stand straight up, be regal. And she works really hard at being that. And so to see her really own her position that she has to take on in the world that she was just trying to get away from is like such a beautiful journey for this character and like a redemption in a way that I didn't even realize that she needed, but she kind of did. I just love her in this.
In the way that I felt like Frozen 2 completes the character arcs for Anna and Elsa that you didn't necessarily think they needed, but they actually did. That's what I feel like is happening in this story, particularly with Ariel, is you don't think that she needs more of a complete character arc in the original story. But once you get this, you're like, oh no, we needed all of this. We needed to see who she was going to grow into as a result of what we saw happen in the original story.
Yeah. And it had me turning back on the original Broadway cast recording of Little Mermaid just because I remembered how much I love this character. And like that's some of the reason I liked the musical, just because I loved her. I wanted a deepening of Ariel. I wanted to know more about her. And so it really just had me going back for more of the original character. And I think that is the number one sign of success. Like it just it made me want more Ariel. And that's
yeah,
I love her
I'm
so much.
I'm not a huge Ariel person myself. This book made me much more of an Ariel person. I was like, I'm on your side, sis.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Let's raise some hell. Let's do these things. Because frequently when I watch The Little Mermaid, I'm just sort of like, ugh, God.
Yeah.
And here I'm like, no, I'm with you. With you. Like, absolutely. Another character that I thought was done really, really well that was a strength to this book was Eric. We get to carve out more about Eric than we've ever known before, and even more than we get in the film, Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea.
We get
Eric
nothing.
Feels
we
even more two-dimensional than the first film, which everyone always sort of says Eric is basically like a cardboard cutout in the original film anyway. But this book gives us a version of Eric that is just a lot more complex. We get to explore some of his life, learn about his past, learn about what he was like when he was a kid with his parents.
And his family.
Has a family. He has a sister. His relationship to Grimsby, how much he cares about Grimsby.
It made that Eric from the film makes why he can sometimes seem like a cardboard cutout. It made it make sense. Because that it's like, I loved that he is not 100% the sharpest tool. And he can be a little bit dreamy. He's not like a perfect, like gallant soldier all the time. He's more of an artist. And so then it really makes you go back and fill in who you're seeing in the film. And you're like, oh, it's not because he's a cardboard cutout and, you know, Disney did a bad job. It's because he is a little bit moody and distant because that's just who he is. I loved it.
Yeah, we rounded him out. He has desires. He has passions. And he has an awareness around who he is. He has an awareness around who he was in that original story, that more like aloof type of character. Like, I think it's fantastic in the scene where he and Ariel are talking and he's just frustrated at himself for not trusting his heart with Ariel, but instead obsessing over the fact that the girl of his dreams didn't have the voice that he remembered. Like that frustration, I'm like, yes, you feel the frustration that we as an audience have felt, and you're able to feel it in hindsight. I'm like, that's an interesting character choice for you. And then also just the moment where he has, when Ariel's getting frustrated and she's like, how did you, she's like, you saw my face, you know what I, you knew what I looked like. And yeah, I lost my voice, but you could still see my face. And he was like, you have to remember that I was in a shipwreck. I was in bed for weeks with fever. And he was like, I almost didn't make it beyond that.
He's still like, sometimes my chest still hurts from being in that accident. Yeah,
there's this like recovery period from the shipwreck that Ariel took for granted that I'm like, oh, I have a lot more respect for what Eric was actually going through in all of that because, getting saved from a shipwreck is not as simple as you feel the sun on your face, you hear a beautiful voice, and you wake up.
You are unwell. But
there's a recovery period with that.
Yeah.
And then the last character that I sort of, I really enjoyed was Vanessa / Ursula. Mm-hmm. I loved that we got to see Ursula more in this Vanessa form.
Yes, more Vanessa.
And I like the spinning out this world where Ursula's motives are slightly shifted from where they were in the original film. Because a lot of people have complained with this book where they're like, this doesn't make sense because her entire plan was to rule the sea, not the land, rule the sea, not the land. And I'm like, I like teasing out this idea of like, what if when she was on land posing as Vanessa, she had this new idea of, hey, I can have both. And then in those sort of improvisations that she does, have to recalculate because she didn't fully understand all the variables on the table. Like the fact that she can't use magic when she's on land. Like that's so interesting to me. And like the fact that she has to be touching salt water in order to use her magic. I'm like, this is really compelling to me. And it's much more interesting for a character that otherwise has a very direct motive in the original film where it's like she was slighted by Triton. She wants to get back at Triton and rule the sea. So she's using the daughter to get to him. Now it's like, that's great. She kind of did that. She got back at Triton. She fucking killed him. And now she's like, I'm going to rule the sea. But also I kind of love how awful humans already kind of instinctually are. Can I capitalize on that too? I love it. I think
that's
it's so interesting.
That's why she's such a good villain. Exactly. Yeah, that's why she's such a good villain is because she's just like looking for the situation in which she can have the most power. So it makes perfect sense. And they also leaned a lot on her ultimate motivation behind all of this, which was her being banished from Atlantica. So it really does all follow through.
Yeah.
Because she's banished from there. And so she's like, I'm – and here – because she's Vanessa, but still, people are fawning all over her. She can do whatever she wants. And it's interesting that even Ariel is confused by it, which I think is so interesting. She says to her, like, these people, these humans don't truly understand who you are. You are Ursula, the witch of the sea. That's huge to everybody in Atlantica. But all of these people, they don't quite know that. So why are you trying to control them? Like, it's all accounted for. Her motivation is completely sound.
Yeah. And I think what's also really great about that, too, is the characters in this story point out that Ursula's real power is her ability to find the thing that you most care about and exploit that. And I'm like, because that is one of my criteria for what makes a fantastic villain.
Yes.
And they outright said Ursula's a freaking pro at it. And she really is. And it's like that more than anything that she does, she cannot resist finding something that you love and taking it from you.
Yeah. You know what I also loved about her? And I actually mean this in a good way. Some of the fun was sucked out of Ursula in this book. And I think it allowed me to take a step back and really consider that we brush off all of the evil things that she does a little bit when you really examine the specific evil things she does in the original film, because she's funny and she's campy and all fabulous. These things. And she's fabulous. But then this book really allows you to be like, to parse apart all of the things that she's done. And she is bad. I remember walking away from this and I'm like, it's so funny. She is our mascot, but I didn't realize she's bad, bad.
She kills people in this book.
She's bad.
Like, she can't. And the polyps, she's like, I can't figure out how to use magic to kill you. So I'm going to figure out how to like brew poison and kill you that way.
She's like, I'm going to have these people's blood like wash over the town. And then it's just like, it even like the polyps are very disturbing in the film too, but the way the polyps were described in this freaked me out. And you're just like, oh my God, now it's hitting me what this woman is doing, because you're realizing that those polyps were people. And now when the story is taking place, it's been 5 years of being sentient but being physically a polyp and not being able to communicate or be a person. And they're it's mind blowing. She is bad, bad, real bad.
Yeah.
I just love the reappearances of Scuttle. I thought Jonah was, I loved Jonah.
I did too.
I felt like I had known her for years. I cannot explain why. I felt like Jonah had always been a part of this universe. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I just, all of the sidekicks returning and how they've changed over time.
I liked that Sebastian kind of took a backseat
yes,
in this
yes,
story.
Yes, agree.
And we got to spend like, more time with Flounder.
I agree. And then the little moments where like Flounder doesn't, it really moved me. I don't know why, but it's like where Flounder doesn't want people to see that he still likes it when Ariel pets and hugs him. It almost broke me.
Yes.
You can hear it. It's like, I don't know why. That's exactly the small things that I want out of these like sort of like what if fan fiction moments, because I can't get it out of my head that it's like there's this one moment where it's like he lets Ariel like, you know, tuck him under her chin because nobody else is watching. And I was just like, oh my God. Like,
because even the sidekick has changed. Like yeah. that's the level here where it's not like mm-hmm. the main character has changed. No, everyone has changed.
Yes.
Everyone.
Yes. And I just as a small thing, but Verit, who is Vanessa's maid, what a freaking clever part of the story, because she doesn't take a front seat at any moment. She's never a huge deal. And again, this doesn't spoil anything. She closes out the story and it's so subtle and you're like not entirely sure why she does. But then deep down, you sort of do know why she has been the thread through the whole story. And mm-hmm. I just thought that was just really sophisticated storytelling. And once again, a part of the story that really moved me, where Prince Eric does something really kind for her and you don't know what she's going to do for a moment. And then she's a young girl. She like flings her arms around him. I was going to text you when I was on the toilet reading it and I cried
yeah.
on the toilet. It's just so well done. Oh my gosh.
For me, I felt there were some missed opportunities with Verit because I did think that she was a compelling character, but that's where I wish that they might have gone a little bit further.
Oh.
But personally, I thought Verit was Triton.
Oh,
I
damn.
Thought Ursula had disguised Triton as Verit because she was the only one that she trusted to see her in her octopus form.
Wait, stop. That would have blown my mind.
And that's why, like, when there's the moment of Ariel reaching for the thing and Verit sees uh-huh. her and she looks at her but, like, doesn't say anything, I was like, oh, my God, that could have been Triton being like, take the fucking locket.
Wow. That's so good. My gosh. There's really only one. It's so tiny, but I just have to mention it because I think you're going to laugh. There was only one small character moment that I was like, huh? This seems so random, and I'll just mention it because it's just a me thing. But Connor has also given me an explanation that I will not include because it's spoilery. But there's a moment in the story where I believed that Eric was about to let Ariel just completely sacrifice herself and was kind of like, I'm really sorry. Okay, bye. And I was really upset. And it was towards the end of the book and I was like, wait, I'm suddenly very not okay with him.
I thought it was all part of the plan.
Okay. But then, you know, sorry, this is a spoiler. But then he does get a tattoo of Ariel's name in mermaid runes around his arm. And that is just one of the hottest things I've ever heard in my life. So
I
it's
was
okay.
reading that moment and I had like a sort of eye roll moment, but I
oh,
knew.
Oh, no, not me.
I knew that Caroline on the other end was living
was
for
like,
this.
Oh, my God. Because she's talking about it being around his like large bicep. And I was just like, oh, yes. In mermaid runes? Forget it.
Oh, God. All right. So for everything that's going well with the characters in this book, as we're building them out more, Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea.
Yay!
Before we go into what's going wrong here, I will talk uh-huh. about some of the things that
okay.
I do think are going
okay.
are going in the favor of it.
Okay.
For Melody, I was like, she makes sense, but that's about it. I don't think she's extremely compelling as a character. Does mm-hmm. she make sense that she would be there? Yeah.
Here's what I'll say about her. I kind of agree. I remember there was something about her that I felt very drawn to when I was a kid, and I've heard the same from other people our age. I think it was smart having her be around 12 because I connected with her as a child because she was closer to my age than typical Disney princesses who are like 16, 18, all that stuff. And in a way, you mentioned this earlier, I'm kind of torn now about if it's a good thing, but this age that they chose for her also led the film away from romance being a main component of the story. And talking as me personally, I never have a problem with romance being part of the story, but we didn't. In the Little Mermaid world, we've had enough of that. And so I think it was nice to adjust it in that way, even though they still had to like slip in her those flirting boys. With boys. Yeah. And I was like, did we have to do that?
Yeah.
That really bothered me. It just is teaching young girls that it's like even at 12, you need to like flirt with the boy, impress the boy. No, 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 no.
And I'm fine with them removing romance from the equation. I think when you do that, though, you just got to give me another compelling reason why she yes. wants to stay in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, it was just something that she wasn't allowed to do.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually do like the growth that we get in Ariel's character here, just because the original Ariel can be so naive. And mm-hmm. it's nice to see her a little bit more grounded as a mother and dealing with a child that challenges her in the way that she challenged Triton. It adds a bit more depth to her character, especially because she doesn't really react to Melody in the more extreme way that Triton reacted to Ariel's grotto.
Mm.
I don't know. It just shows a little bit more sophistication in this Ariel that we also see in the book. It comes with that age. It comes with the experience. And I just sort of like how she uses her experiences from the film in mm-hmm. order to parent Melody.
Uh-huh.
Even though she's sheltering her, there's a reason behind it. And when she shelters her, it's not in an abrasive or rude way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can see from the look on your face, you have differing opinions about Ariel.
No, not nothing extreme. She seemed like a little bit of a lame mom to me, which like I would expect Ariel to have really specific views about being a parent after like losing her mom and then the really fraught relationship she had with her father. Also, just like I did enjoy seeing her be more mature, but there just wasn't a lot of the Ariel that I love left.
Sure.
She would still, as a mom of a younger girl, she would be having fun. They would be being silly. She seemed, I know that like Melody's kind of going through it, going through her, you know, awkward phase. And so that creates distance. But it seemed like when Ariel comes in to prepare her for the ball and like helps her do her hair, like she doesn't seem to quite know how to connect to Melody. And I feel like the Ariel that we know would just be like a little bit more of an in-touch mom than that. And even if you have a hard time connecting with your kid, there would just be some sort of like lightness and fun and spunk to her still, because not that much time has passed. I mean, I guess 12 years is a lot, maybe 14. But I just didn't feel like we didn't have the fun moment of being like, oh, she's a mature woman now, but oh, there's a little bit of that. Of that young girl who will always be inside of
yeah,
her.
Yeah, or to have a couple more private moments with Ariel, like we see her when she's like stepping in the water and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't think it was really hitting home for us how long she has been without
yes.
seeing her family. She had to put up yeah. a wall between her
yeah.
and her family. Like, she makes that decision that Melody will never know anything about her family and she'll never go into the ocean and neither will Ariel. That's an extreme mm-hmm. decision, and there's a lot of emotional consequences that come
yeah.
with that. And I could have used with a little bit more emotion from Ariel of like, maybe she
yeah.
had to like kill that
exactly.
part of herself that like she doesn't think about it because it hurts too much. And it would have been
yeah.
nice to see her think about it a little bit more and feel the
yeah.
hurt of it.
She just felt she felt very bland to me, which is literally the last thing that Ariel is. And the two best moments she has are the one you mentioned where she puts her feet in the water for a moment and like throws her head back and like is remembering all of that feeling. And then at the end of the movie, when she and Eric jump in the water and she like grabs him and kisses him, I'm like, there she is. What happened?
Yeah.
Like, what happened to her? Like, I want to see her bring that, like, spice for life into her relationship with her daughter, because that's who Ariel is.
Yeah. The other characters that I pointed out as sort of like adding something to the story that we hadn't seen before, not because I particularly love these characters, but Tip and Dash.
Ugh.
Tip and Dash.
Ugh.
I think in terms of deepening the story, they do provide a different kind of comedic relief for the film than we are used to or have had introduced in the original film. Flounder and Sebastian, they're a bit smarter, a bit more intellectual, and Tip and Dash are more of like a Laurel and Hardy physical comedy type. So again, not saying that they're the best characters by any means, but for a movie that is so much about things that are the same, it was nice to bring in a different type of comedy to the film.
Gotcha. Yeah, I just, there was nothing interesting about them. For me, also, just the introduction of those two characters alone, like when they're trying to rescue the little penguin, what a waste of time in an already short film. I was like, please move along from that. I was like so mad. I don't know why we wasted such a boring sequence on introducing these two. And yes, they're based off of, like you said, the Laurel and Hardy, you know, typical thing that works. But I'm actually tired of the small and bossy guy with like the larger, timid one. If it's at least fun, it's one thing. And I didn't think it was funny.
Technically, that's the opposite of Laurel and Hardy.
Right, right.
But yeah.
I'm comparing it to...
I know what you mean.
I'm comparing it to Timon and Pumbaa.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Timon and Pumbaa are fun and interesting and funny. And these two aren't. And... I just, oh my gosh. And then they got a song? They got a song.
Yeah.
We could have Ariel and Eric sing something. We could have Ariel sing another solo. We could have Melody. No, absolutely not. Morgana is the song that was cut. And I was going to say, oh, they definitely should have kept it. But Morgana, I mean.
Yeah, let's go for it. I felt like this is the moment that we've probably been building toward the entire episode. Yeah. Fucking Morgana.
She pains me. Like, they tried to make... So she's the same as Ursula, but they were like, oh, okay, here's what we can do. We can give her a mommy complex. So she just wants to try to interrule the seas so that she can be better than Ursula, because Ursula was never able to do it. Every time I saw her, I felt so sad, because it's Pat Carroll doing the voice, and you're like, how could you do this to Pat Carroll?
Yeah.
And then it's so bad to the point where you see a picture, like, in Morgana's lair ice cave thing. There's a picture of Ursula. And even seeing that picture made me sad, because I had a memory of what the villain could be. And I was like, please come back and make this movie interesting in some way. Like, yeah. I think having the villain be related to Ursula was just generally a weak choice. As the Twisted Tales books prove to me, there's rich lore to draw from in the sea world. We've touched on the gods a little bit. And so many more villain options in this type of story about a child who is between two worlds than one so tied and similar to the original, who is also one of the best and most iconic villains of all time.
Exactly. Like, she's just a skinny ripoff of Ursula. She's green instead of purple. And she's pulling the same sort of maleficent gig of showing up at a birthday party baptism and like wrecking their shit. I'm like, these are all things that we've seen before. It's not helped by the fact that Pat Carroll is there, because now too many things in the design and execution of the character are causing us to make those direct comparisons to Ursula. And that's not good. Mm-hmm. They had this opportunity to create an equally cool villain with maybe some nods to Ursula. But like, this movie, after all, was kind of a bigger deal as a sequel when it came out. And they had so many original cast members that they really could have elevated this direct-to-video film. They could have elevated the genre in general. And they didn't. The best place to start by doing that is with an incredible villain. Give us a memorable villain that are like, okay, maybe the rest of this movie is trash, but this villain is freaking awesome and won't be discounted. Like, in kind of the way that Beauty and the Beast and the Enchanted Christmas works, when you've got Tim Curry as Forte, Forte's kind of a great villain.
Agreed.
It's even more painful to me because even as Ursula's sister, she's not even a good villain. She has to literally use Ursula's magic in order to do any of the good stuff. And then even when she's defeated at the end and she's in the ice block and she's sinking down, the last image we see of the villain's defeat isn't Morgana. It's a picture of Ursula floating down right after her.
Yep.
And I'm like, that is a sign that you did not do your job in creating a good enough villain for us.
Exactly. Also, isn't that ice going to melt?
Yeah,
being underwater. Bottom of the ocean, it's warm. She's not gone.
But they are in Antarctica, remember? right next to the sandy beaches.
Of pretty much Italy. Okay.
So that's everything that I've got. Do you have anything else?
Yeah, me too. No. I think to kind of start tying it all together, when we were finishing up the book and the film, and I said to Connor, I'm like, wait, this isn't even a contest. Like, how can we do a showdown with this? I think you mentioned to me, you know, a lot of people really love this movie, feel tied to this movie. And I like had a tie to it when I was younger too. And I think in a way that makes the perfect case for Part of Your World being the Little Mermaid sequel you should turn to, because it matches where we're at now.
Yeah.
We liked the Little Mermaid 2 Return to the Sea because we were like 9 around there and Melanie was 12 and we liked that. But this is for us, this book.
Yeah. For as upset as you will be being an older person watching Little Mermaid 2 Return to the Sea again, that same amount of frustration that you feel will be channeled into some delight in reading this book.
I like thoroughly enjoyed this book.
Yeah.
It's like it feeds every part of me that like loves fan fiction.
Yeah.
In a really sophisticated way. It's so good.
Yeah, and it's I don't know, there's something different about reading fan fiction on fanfiction.com or .net or whatever.
You're like, "Oh, this is legit. It's hardbound."
Reading something that's published and put in a hardbound and it has Disney's imprint on it where they're like, "Yeah, okay, yeah, we're going to include this." So,
yeah.
It was really a surprise for me because I like The Little Mermaid. I don't love The Little Mermaid. Mm-hmm. And it was truly the biggest and most wonderful surprise to me. It was just a pleasure to get through. And it was, I didn't want it to end. I also couldn't put it down either. I was like, like if you really set your mind to it, this could be a one sitting book. You could just knock
definitely,
the
and it
could
be really enjoyable that way.
Yeah.
Like, I was getting towards the climax when I was reading it on my lunch break and I had to put it down and I was tense.
Yeah.
I truly was. And I'm sure, I don't really know. That's what's interesting. That's why I really want to plug this, because on paper, like, this book series is totally up my alley, but I've always skipped over and I've been like, oh, it's for kids. Yeah. I'm not going to like it. Definitely not true. And I'm sure this won't be the case, but I enjoyed this so much that I'm almost a teeny weeny bit nervous about reading another one in the series because I loved this so much. But I'm sure everything else will measure up. I'm really excited.
This is the first of these books that we have read, and it will certainly not be the last. There are so many more that we will continue to read, and you probably will see them maybe even resurface again later down the line, because I'm very excited to read some more. I mean,
yeah.
Alrighty, folks. Well, that's going to do it for us. Clearly, as we've gone through this, Part of Your World, A Twisted Tale is our winner today. If you've enjoyed this episode, please remember to hit follow or subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast and leave a rating and review. Those ratings and reviews do so much for us in terms of just knowing that the work that we're doing is going in the right direction, but also helping other people find the podcast to bring more people into our community. So thank you for taking just a couple seconds right now at the end of this podcast to tap 5 stars and just write a couple words down of something that you loved about this episode or about the podcast in general.
And please follow us on social media. We are at Poor Unfortunate Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and we are at Unfortunate Pod on Twitter. Definitely pop over to the socials and tell us if you've been reading the Twisted Tales book, which ones we should read next. Let us know what you think of Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea. We've just had a lot of fun things going on. We just kind of closed out all of our spooky season stuff, had a little feature of all of the amazing Disney Halloween costumes that y'all dressed up this Halloween. They were wonderful. So there's always something extra going on social media that we sometimes don't even mention on the pod. Just a little bit more fun for you. And if you want more of a chance to discuss the episodes, discuss Disney news, meet some other listeners, and get to talk more with us, please join us in the Poor Unfortunate Fam, which is our private Facebook group. We would love to get to know you a little bit better over there and have you connect with some other members of the fam who were ready to welcome you with open arms. So come on down.
And it does take us a little bit of money to keep the podcast up and running and coming to you all. We do have a PayPal account that is linked in the episode description and in the website links in our social media accounts. Truly, anything that you might be able to spare goes a long way for us. You can make a one-time donation, a monthly donation. It can be $5, $10, $20, more than that. It all just goes right back into the podcast. It helps us cover the basic costs, keeping it free and for the most part ad-free whenever possible. So again, we are looking for 10 people to donate at least $5 before the end of the year. For those of you who have donated already, we really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And if you are someone who's been on the fence about donating but have been enjoying the podcast for the past year and a half plus, please consider leaving us a little tip just to say, well done, keep going. So thank you very much for that.
Yeah, and if money's a little bit tight for you with the holidays coming, a review, truly, 5 stars and a little bit of a comment goes just as far, and it's totally free.
Social media shout out.
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes.
Please. Tell your friends. We're here.
Tell your friends.
And we want them. All righty, friends. Until next time.
Beluga Savruga. Savruga.